This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our Main Street across the state of North Dakota this time of day. As we, you know, wander about our towns where we live, we might wonder, well, what was here before we were? And the answer quite often is somebody else. And today we're going to talk about that with Martin Case. He's the author of The Relentless Business of Treaties, How Indigenous Land Became U.S. Property, and he joins us by phone from his home in South Minneapolis. Thanks for being with us, Martin.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you write the book?
I stumbled across a list of names of people who signed treaties for the U.S. government. And I looked at them for about 20 minutes and realized, wow, there are stories to be told in these lives. And as it turned out, over about the next 10 years, I learned so much about U.S. history by looking at the U.S. signers of treaties that eventually I interested the Minnesota Historical Society in it.
So you look at this question from a broad sense and also focus in on the state of Minnesota.
The Historical Society Press in Minnesota wanted some kind of focus on it. So I've looked at all the treaties, U.S. indigenous treaties, and the guys who signed them. So I trace how states were carved out of these various territories and eventually converged on Minnesota, which actually gets into North Dakota a bit, too.
Sure. There are hundreds of treaties out there, and one line from your blurb for the book really caught my eye, and I think it'll catch the ear of our listeners, too. Odds are the deed to the land under your home rests on this system.
Right. The simple story we get is that the U.S. Expanded by getting land from France or land from Spain. But in fact, when we made the Louisiana Purchase, for example, all we were buying was the exclusive right to negotiate for land with indigenous groups, which is kind of a mind blower. So the U.S. did not actually have a title to any land that it could distribute until there was an Indian land cession.
So for $5 million to Napoleon of France, we get the Louisiana Purchase. We actually buy the rights to negotiate.
That's right. And then it takes multiple millions more to secure those land cessions from other nations.
Well, you mentioned several big treaties, the first being the treaty with Great Britain that ends the Revolutionary War.
Right.
So then we can negotiate treaties with the Native Americans that were on that brand new coast we've created, the acquisition of Florida from Spain, the annexation of the Republic of Texas, the Oregon Treaty, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Lots of big treaties here.
Enormous.
With hundreds of smaller ones within them. What do you mean by the title, The Relentless Business of Treaties?
Well, one of the surprises to me was that when you look at who was actually at these events, where, say, the Red Lake Band was ceding the land that Fargo's in. The U.S. representatives were actually land speculators and mining company owners who very often had a very personal business interest in the U.S. acquiring that land because then they could get it from the U.S. I wasn't expecting to find that when I looked at who signed the treaties. But virtually every treaty has some business interest represented right there on the site.
Wow.
As the deal's going down.
So as we're pushing west, the people who have the most to benefit from that expansion are the ones who are sitting across the table from the Native American.
Exactly. And then, you know, kind of balancing that, a lot of times they're related to the people on the other side of the table.
Wow. Gets tangled. What makes a treaty different than a contract?
A treaty is an international agreement. So, today we're kind of trained to think of all indigenous people as a race, but these weren't interracial agreements. They were international agreements. Hmm. And a lot of those indigenous nations had a lot of local autonomy. So, for instance, 1863, the U.S. makes a treaty with the Red Lake Band of the Ojibwa. representing the Ojibwe nation. So it's that nationhood of indigenous people that's kind of written out of the history books, but they still have some of that original sovereignty, even in our system. It's that nationhood that makes it a treaty.
In the history of the United States, are there examples of native peoples promoting treaties with the U.S. government, or was the process almost always the government proposing the treaty to the native peoples?
Well, especially early on, there were native people looking for treaties because the U.S. was the newcomer, and they had their own relations. So the Dakota and the Ojibwe were jockeying for position against each other.
Okay.
So they were interested in a treaty with Spain or France or the U.S. or Great Britain to get arms and trade goods, but with a mind to a different indigenous nation rather than, you know, to that European power.
Well, you mentioned that these treaties often involved people who had something to gain on the U.S. side of the signing ledger. Mm-hmm. In your research, did you come across evidence of concern from the dominant culture, the government, about the ethics and morality of treaty negotiations?
Oh, certainly. There was always somebody on the spot who was trying to rat out the more egregious examples of abuse, you know, but for the most part, it was set up to for the U.S. to acquire this land and all those resources and get them into the hands of individuals and corporations, because that's how the U.S. stayed solvent. It acquired Indian land and then sold it. So once you set up that system, it's kind of ripe for abuse. Especially if the people who want to buy the land are running the negotiation. But certainly, like, missionaries had a lot of concern about some of the native people they worked with. There were Indian agents who had good relationships in some cases, and then in other cases were among the most corrupt people in the system. But so it was a mixed bag there.
We tend to, as the dominant culture, look at treaties as the rights the United States government has conferred on native peoples. Here's your reservation. Enjoy it. Doesn't the genesis of treaties suggest the exact opposite? Here's our
Absolutely.
Land. You can use it under these circumstances.
That's right. Those treaty rights that I think most Americans become aware of treaties when some indigenous group asserts a treaty right. And the origin of those rights isn't the Constitution. They weren't given those rights by the U.S. They had them before there was a U.S. and kept those rights through treaty making. Mm-hmm. So on that other side, treaties are really important to indigenous people today because a lot of their sovereignty they have retained, a lot of their land base, those go right back to the treaties too.
Now, when these treaties were enacted, the U.S. government concept of land was sort of, I guess, the Western European one, land ownership. It's quite
right.
Different from the kind of native tradition, which is kind of kinship with the land, you know. We're all on the land kind of thing. So that was making the natural world private property. That's a bit of a tricky concept, I suspect, for an indigenous person to wrap his mind around.
Right. You know, I think the way we relate to the natural world, that's complicated in any society. So I think a lot of white people, for instance, have a sense of kinship with the natural world. Certainly indigenous people owned things. They didn't relate to the land itself that way. But the crux of the matter is, what's the fundamental relationship that's going to run your society? Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., that's property. For a lot of indigenous groups, that was, you know, relative making. They were parts of the natural world were relatives. So that's a very different way of looking at the world. And the treaties were about what's going to be the main way of relating to the world.
Well, in my part of the country growing up in the Detroit Lakes area, we had the White Earth Reservation north of us. And there was a sort of a famous incident or a series of incidents that took place there in the late 19th century where native peoples on that land were ceded property, given property, and with all the rights and responsibilities thereof, which meant they had to pay taxes. And if they didn't pay taxes, then they forfeited that land. So it was sort of imposing an ownership structure on people who didn't really understand it or believe it. And then they forfeit the land because they didn't understand it or believe it.
Right. And part of that was another land acquisition scheme. What the U.S. did at various points, but everywhere in Indian country, except over at Red Lake, handed out individual land titles to individual indigenous people. And then after everybody got their 160 acres, if there was any left over, the U.S. just sold it to non-tribal people. So if you look at White Earth, it's just a checkerboard of land owned by the tribe and tribal members and land owned by non-tribal members. Red Lake is unique in that they were able to maintain common ownership of that all their reservation land. I don't think there's any other place in the country that did that.
Well, when I was a kid, we referred to the Red Lake Reservation as a closed reservation and White Earth as an open reservation. But there's a White Earth Land Recovery Project has been underway for quite a long time now, trying to sort of reclaim land within those traditional boundaries.
That's right. All reservation land is technically held in trust by the federal government. So in order to make more land part of the reservation, first the tribes have to buy the land, then they need an act of Congress to put it into trust and make it part of the reservation. Very complicated process.
Well, these are treaties. They require an act of Congress and lots of important signatures, and every side gets a copy of it. How enforceable are they today?
There was a point in the early 1900s when Congress just said, we have absolute power over all indigenous people, and kind of from that side changed the playing field, just decided we're not going to treat indigenous groups as nations anymore. That has not always flown in the courts. The Supreme Court has often said those rights are still in effect, that national sovereignty is still retained on some levels, and it's been the courts, really, where I think indigenous people have selectively tried to assert those rights.
And they've had some modest success. But let's talk about that treaty that gave the Dakota Nation the right to the Black Hills.
Right. Immediately then, white people started going into the Black Hills with shovels.
Yeah, digging up gold and saying, you're not welcome here.
Right. So the U.S. Actually sent troops to protect that border from U.S. citizens trying to get in. Eventually, you know, there have been so many swings in policy by the United States over the years, just wild swings in what those relationships are going to be. At one point, the U.S. offered a lot of money for the Black Hills, would have made a lot of Indians, you know, comfortably off. And the Lakota said no, that land and that relationship was more important. So that's still kind of an ongoing point of contention, of course.
And that was part of the issue of the Dakota Access Pipeline protest by the Standing Rock Nation in southwestern North Dakota and, of course, across the border into South Dakota. They were looking at their traditional lands as opposed to their reservation lands and trying to preserve their rights or some authority over that. It didn't fly.
Right. Well, there's that big disconnect in how people relate to the land. I don't feel comfortable characterizing Native American positions on this. I'm a white guy.
Sure, me too.
I've looked at the U.S. side. but the big disconnect is if you're looking at the natural world as something you're going to extract wealth from, you're inevitably going to have clashes with some other worldview.
Mm-hmm.
It works out in a lot of different details.
Well, indigenous people, and I saw this in your book, had treaties among themselves when settlers arrived. The Iroquois Confederacy is one you refer to. If so, I mean, what issues would the Iroquois Confederacy have covered among those tribes?
Well, it created the Confederacy. So there were this happened maybe before Columbus, certainly before the 1600s. There were five different nations that were kind of at odds with each other. And at one point, a guy showed up and negotiated this long-lasting peace agreement that created this confederacy of five nations. Then another one was added. So it was basically a peace treaty on steroids in that they agreed to have a common identity. And, you know, they shared some language and they had natural affinities, but this confederacy lasted right into the American Revolution, hundreds of years.
But it makes you think that there would have been other indigenous tribal groups across the country that would have made arrangements with the next tribe over or whatever. Weren't these kinds of agreements somewhat common?
They were. I was just at Red Lake night before last, as a matter of fact, talking about this with an indigenous scholar named David Wilkins from the U. And he made the point that this international diplomacy among indigenous groups was kind of seen as making relatives. So they'd create these bonds where we're going to say, okay, we're making a family here.
So the Prince of Hungary marries the Princess of Austria kind of thing.
That's the surprising thing.
Uh-huh.
That Europeans had these family connections running the thing too, right?
When these agreements existed, and I suspect that people pushing west would have discovered that in their relationships mm-hmm. with the tribes they came across, were these intertribal agreements taken under consideration when the U.S. was writing treaties?
Certainly. And a lot of times the U.S. kind of consciously tried to drive a wedge into those agreements, but when the U.S. first started moving into, say, Ohio, for instance, all the various tribes in Ohio, and that included the Ojibwa, the Potawatomi, the Miami, they were all kind of united in opposition. And it took 20 years for the U.S. to secure any land in Ohio. And they started out in Pennsylvania, you know, right on the other side of the border. And eventually they kind of sheared off a couple of tribes to sign a treaty and picked their way through those negotiating landmines.
Well, there can be some quirky realities to treaties these days. I mean, we have mm-hmm. treaties that cross international borders. I suspect right. there are tribal lands that cross into Canada or Mexico. And how might that affect a border wall or border security, for that matter?
Right. You know, one thing that really affected that was 9/11. There was something called the Jay Treaty that was in place from the 1700s so that the Mohawk, for instance, a lot of them lived in Canada and worked on skyscrapers in New York. Same with the Ojibwa on the Minnesota-Canadian border. They basically had the right of free passage across that border. 9/11, they clamped down on everybody going across that border. And that's kind of created the context for, you might say, indigenous invisibility when we're talking about the border wall down south.
Hmm. If we were to strictly follow the original intent of current treaties, what would be different?
Well, you know, that mindset that the U.S. is one nation in North America, and we actually share it with a lot of other nations, that's going to change things in a lot of details. And I think indigenous people would have one or 100 answers to this. But I think there'd be a lot less assault on indigenous rights, a lot less resistance to indigenous people keeping a land base. And, you know, if those treaties were recognized as international agreements, a lot of U.S.-Indian relations would make more sense than it generally does in public discourse. When indigenous people are asserting their hunting and fishing rights, a lot of times that comes across as somebody's getting special treatment here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you realize that's a nation asserting its sovereignty, it makes a little more sense, I think.
Well, as you well know, in the modern world, there are places where tribal interests trump political strength. Can history perhaps inform us how to better deal with conflicts in Africa, in the Middle East, because of the way we tried to deal with them in our own country?
Right. Those examples have spread throughout the world in strange ways. And I go on the one extreme end of the scale. Hitler wrote that he really admired the way the U.S. handled Indians. and then today there are people, economists, who are suggesting, the salvation of Africa is to give individuals land titles, clear up land titles, so they can take out loans on their land from Western banks. And that's a little, I'm not an economist, but it sounds kind of sketchy to me. On the other hand, I think in America we have a hard time recognizing the sovereignty of other nations. And works a lot better if we do, I think.
Martin Case is the author of The Relentless Business of Treaties, How Indigenous Land Becomes U.S. Property. And I went online to Amazon.com, where your book is for sale, and I came across a sort of a review from a history reader. Let me just share you this brief review. While Mr. Case has delved into an historical area outside of my reading, pulling together data and concepts and placing them before my attention, my understanding of early 19th century history makes me question whether there was a conclusion already drawn before he started. How would you answer that?
A conclusion drawn. I'm not sure what the conclusion would have been, but
it suggests that you would have, these treaties have been abrogated. It's a nasty history.
Oh, certainly. I don't know how you can look at that history and see it as anything other than at least contentious, if not rife with abuse. I don't know. Maybe somebody can look at it and see it in another way. Certainly there's a story in place that these treaties were something that happened long ago and they were bad for Native people. But today, we use this land so well. So there's that kind of march of progress argument that if you can just say the treaties are in the past tense, rather than ongoing, part of ongoing relationships between the U.S. and Native people, then you can put a happy ending on this story. In looking at who signed them and the presence of these corporate interests, I could not get there.
We'll have to leave it at that.
Yeah.
Martin Case is the author of The Relentless Business of Treaties, How Indigenous Land Became U.S. Property. It's published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Thank you, Martin, for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, we'll learn about the Mountain West News Bureau. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. An interim legislative committee is still looking at the issue of a fully funded health insurance plan for state employees versus a self-insurance plan where the state would take over and assume the risk. Currently, the state has a contract with Sanford to provide the health benefits. The bill being considered by the Interim Health Care Reform Review Committee would give the public employees retirement system the option to go to self-insurance.
The only issue really is, can the state of North Dakota have an insurance plan which saves money? And if we go to self-insurance, can we save money relative to being fully insured?
Bismarck Republican Representative George Kaiser chairs the committee. He says some of his committee wants to give PERS the flexibility to reduce benefits, which would save money. However,
it is a matter of trust with our public employees. We can say that we'll put the flexibility in and say we don't intend to do anything, but that trust, I don't think will be there.
The committee plans to meet once more to take final action on whether it will recommend the bill be introduced in the 2019 legislature. Otter Tail Power Company wants the authority to give new or expanding industrial customers a break on their electric rates to spur economic development. Otter Tail has asked the North Dakota Public Service Commission for the right to offer up to a five-year discount for a new customer using at least 500 kilowatt hours of electricity and for expanding customers who would be using at least 1,500 kilowatt hours. Commissioner Brian Crosha says he likes the concept.
It helps to incent and attract new business to our state, and it's not at the expense of existing customers that, in this case, Otter Tail serves. So we're always trying to, as a state, I believe, look for ways to be more attractive from a business standpoint, and utility rates for larger businesses definitely come into play in terms of overall cost of doing business.
MDU has a similar program, but Xcel Energy does not. And some new drivers in North Dakota are able to skip the road test before getting their license. The change was made last spring. DOT Motor Vehicle Director Glenn Jackson says it's taking pressure off state driver's license examiners.
Our driving instructors, driver's classes, and some schools, they can now designate which of their students are really doing very well that they do not believe need to take a road test with us, and they can give them a certificate that we will accept as evidence of having completed the road test. So we don't have to test them a second time.
Jackson, who says he'd prefer to see more private and school-sponsored driving courses, calls the driving test opt-out an efficiency improvement. Eventually, Jackson says the state may save money by allowing instructors to issue certificates. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Kate Concannon. She is the managing editor of the Mountain West News Bureau, and she joins us from Seattle, Washington. Thanks for being with us, Kate.
Oh, my pleasure, Doug. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about your news bureau. What do you cover? How big an area?
Well, we cover five states in the Mountain West, which, as you know, is a huge area. We're a collaboration of public media stations around those states. We have a couple of stations in Colorado, Boise State Public Radio in Idaho, Montana, Utah, and Wyoming. So a huge region.
How did Mountain West News Bureau get started?
Well, it's all part of a movement towards regional collaborations where public radio stations all work together and have central reporters and a managing editor to cover issues that are sort of relevant to a larger region. Some of them have been, you know, focused on a beat. You've got Harvest, which you may have heard of, which looks at agricultural stories, farm stories around the nation. You've got Fronteras is another long-running one that looks, that's in the Southwest, and it looks at border issues and immigration. Our collaboration is more focused on geography. You know, the states I mentioned, we have a lot in common in terms of the geography of the land, mountains, rivers, huge swaths of public land. So a lot of the issues that we deal with, you know, sort of fall under those lines. So land and water use, we do a lot of stories tied to that. Growth is another big issue in the Mountain West. As you probably know, we're the fastest growing region. I mean, Boise is the fastest growing city in the country right now. Idaho's the fastest growing state, but we also have Denver, Utah, also fast growing. So growth is a big issue. Cultural divide is some of the stories we cover. I mean, that's a national issue and the sort of growing divisiveness here. But, you know, it's also an issue out here. We have some of the most conservative states, but we also have some of the most progressive cities. So there's a conflict there.
Are you funded by this consortium of radio stations across the region?
Well, right now we're in the grant phase, which is how a lot of these consortiums start. So we're getting funding, partial funding, from the CPB. That lasts for a year or two. And then the idea is that the member stations then pick up the funding themselves. And, you know, there's a central pot of money that goes towards covering the salaries and the costs of all the reporters. We have six reporters across those states and myself as the managing editor.
And how did you get there? You don't have a Western accent to my ear.
new. I've been here for quite a long while. I'm originally from the UK. I spent some time up in Canada. That's where I did my journalism schooling and worked at the CBC for a while. And then moved down to the US, worked for National Public Radio for a while as the Western Bureau Chief. Variety of other things. I was a reporter for a while. And then heard about this collaboration and just loved the idea, not only of, you know, sort of running an outfit like this, but also this region. I mean, it's an incredible region. I've lived here for 25 years. Fascinating stories. I actually think I have the best job in public radio, but I may be a little biased.
Water, as you mentioned, is an important issue for the Mountain West News Bureau. And I went up on your website, one of the websites, and saw a story posted about the mother of rivers, which is the Colorado River, in an area which is seeing significant population growth at a time when things are also drying out. So that has to be an interesting tension to deal with.
Well, it is. I mean, as you know, the outdoor industry generally is a very significant economic driver in our region. And in Colorado, rafting, angling, you know, a big part of the economy. You know, there are always swings, you know, in the industry. But definitely, you know, we're seeing a real toll this year with low levels in our rivers. You know, I sent out my reporter to spend time with a couple of river rafting guides, one where they're still managing to get out, but they're not getting out as often. It's tougher because the water's lower. And, you know, it's very stressful for them. And then we spoke to another outfit where they've not been able to get out at all. They had to close down this month, and they're hoping that come September the water levels may be up. But, you know, that's beyond peak season. So, you know, this is going to be a very bad year for them. And, you know, the question, like a lot of these things, is, well, what does this mean? You know, is this a swing that's going to swing back? And even if it does swing back, is it going to get worse? You know, like many things, there's a certain, you know, sort of two little words that tie into these stories, which is climate change. And to what degree is this climate change, and is this going to get worse?
And that has to be very concerning. There is another common issue out there that affects people in our state, and for that matter, the entire United States, and that's the opioid epidemic and all the deaths that have been tied to it. You had a story about the opioid reduction in Wyoming, Montana, and Utah, and I was wondering if you could share with our listeners what some of the elements of that that led to that reduction.
Well, it was interesting. You know, we had seen, you know, the CDC regularly, you know, sort of does a report, a preliminary report, I should say, each month looking at numbers. And there was a lot of coverage in recent days about these, you know, that we were at record highs sort of generally, but there were reductions in the Mountain West. You know, we spoke to a couple of experts. We spoke to somebody at the CDC generally, and he said it's too early to tell, you know, what this means, if you know, this reduction is just a hiccup or if it's going to continue. But it's certainly worth looking at and sort of following. You know, Wyoming was interesting. We spoke to somebody in their public health department, and they said, yes, you know, there have been some policies that may have contributed to this. For example, you know, better access to naloxone, which is the, you know, sort of the overdose drug that folks can take. But they also pointed out that Wyoming is such a small population that, you know, 33% sounds a lot, but it's sort of exaggerated because you're looking at a small population. So I thought that was definitely worth noting. But yes, maybe good news, but too early to tell.
Well, you mentioned naloxone, and there's a story you also have posted about librarians in Salt Lake County, Utah, being sort of on the front line of this, because they're going to start having the capability to distribute naloxone, because I assume that they're in a place where they might come across an overdose.
Yes. Yeah. No, that was very interesting. It's only just started, so we'll see how that goes. But yes, all the librarians in this county have been trained in, you know, in how to actually give it as well.
You had a story, I think it was posted by one of your reporters, Amanda Peacher, about the first indigenous governor candidate for I think the governor of Idaho, this Paulette Jordan, this is we're starting to see this, women and Native Americans pursuing political office.
Yes. You know, that story, we're still working on that story. She's actually out with her today, I think, on a campaign, one of her campaign events. But yes, it's very interesting. You know, if it indeed happens, we will see.
Because this is a former state representative, and if she did win, she would be the first tribal member to be elected governor in the United States and the first female governor in Idaho. So it would be historic, no less than
that. It would.
An end to gerrymandering. I saw that as a head on one of your stories as well, and that's an upcoming feature, so I'm sort of spilling the beans, but then this isn't the Mountain West News Bureau where this is being played here. But what is being pursued? Gerrymandering is an issue across the United States as well, of people who have redrawn districts for political advantage.
That's right. What we're looking at, there are states now, regional, are looking at doing this at the legislative level, putting things on the state agenda, state legislative agenda, to talk about how can we, deal with this. I think Colorado and Utah both have measures for voters to vote on. But as you know, the issue with gerrymandering is it's incredibly complicated. And, people don't really, it's not something they think about every day. And you really have to drill down and research it to even understand how it works and why it's such an issue today.
I was really intrigued by a couple of features that you posted. One was about dark skies, the Dark Sky Reserve in central Idaho.
Yeah.
Share that with our listeners. What is that and why is it important?
Well, it's essentially the first international dark sky reserve, I think, in the country. And it was designated, it's in Idaho, it was designated as such last year. And the idea is to keep light pollution down. I think, there's a town nearby, but there are various rules in place that, in terms of what sort of lighting they have. It has to be street lighting that points down, for example. And the idea is that light pollution means we're losing those beautiful night skies. And I sent my reporter out to spend an evening there. And, it was just this idea of how when you look at the night sky, the folks who were there, it was all about how it made them feel close to nature.
Kate Concannon is the managing editor of the Mountain West News Bureau. We look forward to talking with you again in the future, Kate.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Mary Arth, who wants to remind listeners to remember to dance and sing for Life is Joyful. And by Poplar's Music in Grand Forks, serving educational, church, and family music needs since 1909. And now offering the full line of Yamaha pianos and keyboards in addition to many other instruments and music supplies. More info at poplarsmusic.com.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Aaron Diaz and Dan Beckman. They join us from our microphone in Bismarck, and they're with a touring show called Letters from Home. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us. We're happy to be here.
And Dan, good to hear from you, too.
Thank you for saying so.
Now, this show, Letters from Home, Aaron, is something you put together about 9 years ago?
It is, yeah. My dad was a United States Coast Guard veteran, and we were sitting around at a Sunday night dinner, and he said, you should do a show for veterans. And so we did. We started pulling out all of his old records and putting together singing, tap dancing, and all sorts of fun audience interaction, and it has taken us all over the country. We have been to now 41 states, and we're on our way to hit all 50 pretty soon.
So this is a special show for people who are veterans or have veterans in their family or a military background or just like good music and entertainment, I take it.
Absolutely. It's for everyone, for sure. It's a very patriotic show, so we do honor our veterans and active military and their families, of course, but it is just for everyone. It's for young and old. It's an old-fashioned, good old time. It's a good way to take your memories back or have new ones made, and it's just a little bit of fun.
Well, Aaron, you've been on the ground floor. Dan Beckman, when did you come on board?
Oh, what time is it? about 6 weeks ago.
So you're new to Letters from Home.
I am, yeah.
And what strikes you about this show? What would, if you were to describe it to listeners, how would you describe it?
Well, I would say it's at its heart, it's a USO-style show that's kind of representative of reminiscent of the 1940s. We do songs between the 40s and the 60s, but Aaron and I have such goofy personalities that definitely comes through on stages. Yeah, it's true. It's true. You heard it here first, folks. What I really appreciate about it is that there's a lot of connection between us and the audience. So I think it's rather than them watching a show, it's more of them experiencing something that they're kind of a part of.
Well, let's get a little sample of what the show sounds like. Here's a cut of You're the Top.
At words poetic, I'm so pathetic that I have always found it best, instead of getting them off my chest, to let them rest unexpressed. I hate parading my serenading, as I'll probably miss the bar. But if this ditty is not so pretty, at least it'll tell you how great you are.
Now, come on now.
You're the top.
What?
You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the new museum.
Wow, that's a set of lungs there, Dan.
Hey, thanks. Made it myself.
Yeah, he's got two of them.
Yeah, well, they sing out really well. Lots of classic tunes, I take it, Aaron.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We love to start in the 1940s because that's kind of where I think it was a time when America really was all together as one. And it's thought of as a patriotic time, even if the songs weren't necessarily patriotic at the time. It's thought of as a very wholesome time where the country was all together as one. And so when people think back to that era, they are just moved in a different way than some of the modern music, which is still fantastic, but it just strikes you in a different way.
Well, the Letters from Home, Voices of Victory has a couple of performances in North Dakota, one in Bismarck, one in Fargo. The one in Bismarck is tomorrow. Tell us about it.
We are going to have fun at Touchmark tomorrow, and it's a free performance. We'd love for everyone to come, especially if you know veterans, active military heroes, any family members that would love to come. All ages is great. You know, one of the things I love about the show is it does strike someone different. No matter who you are, it strikes you just a little bit differently. So if you're a kid, you might be hearing the music for the first time. Or if you're an older adult, you might be having memories brought back. And so we hope everyone will come out to that. And then the show the next day is also a free performance as well. So it's just going to be a good family fun time.
And both of these are Touchmark community centers?
Yes, that's right.
And what time are these performances?
The Thursday, the 23rd performance is at 5:30 p.m. And the my schedule is completely changed based on the time zone. So,
but if you go on our website, which is lettersfromhomesingers.com, you can find out information. So you can just click through to the tour dates, and it's lettersfromhomesingers.com. And I think the performance tomorrow is at 6:30 p.m.
Hmm.
This time, Central Time? Are we in Central Time now?
We are in Central Time here.
It's good to be here.
It is. It's very centralizing.
Well, North Dakota does have a little bit of mountain time in it.
Yeah, they do.
How is this enterprise funded, Aaron?
It's funded through a lot of different ways. Sometimes we'll get hired from theaters and things like that or air shows. But in many ways, it's through the Pat Dearth Veterans Performance Fund, which was set up in my father's name. I mentioned earlier that he was the one that started the idea for the show, but he passed away a few years ago. And so we started a fund in his name that allows us to go all over the country to different veterans' homes and retirement homes. And 100% of all of our merchandise goes directly to that fund. So any CDs that are purchased or any Reviving Patriotism t-shirts that are purchased or any kind of pictures or merchandise that we have at the shows funds the performances. So it's been a really fun venture and lets us get to some really neat people that really deserve to be honored and remembered.
Well, hail from the Carolinas, from North Carolina, but you call yourself a nomad now. How long are you on the road doing Letters from Home?
Pretty much all of the time. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of time when we're anywhere other than on the road.
Something like 320 days a year, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, pretty much.
So, Dan, you've been on a whirlwind tour yourself. You just dipped into it.
I just dipped in. I've been doing cruise ships, so I've been all over the world. I'm kind of used to the nomad lifestyle myself, but now I'm traveling on roads instead of rivers, which is kind of fun.
Okay. Aaron, you did some cruise ship work too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I used to work for MSC Cruises for a while, and that was a good old time. And Letters from Home still performs as guest entertainers on cruise ships as well. We'll be on Princess Cruises next year going through the Panama Canal, and we've been on Uncruise Adventures a few times. It's a lot of fun.
And how many times have you been to North Dakota? Is this the first time?
This is the second time we've been here as Letters from Home. We've been to Lisbon before.
Of course, the veterans' home there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, this is a vocal intensive performance, correct?
It is. It's not just singing, it's dancing too. Isn't that right, Dancer Dan?
Yes, it is.
And that includes tap dancing, I take it?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Which I have just learned to do, which is quite fun.
Well, I've got two very different voices here, Aaron and Dan. Is anybody else in the show?
Kind of, yes. Nelson does a really amazing monologue in the middle of the show.
Nelson's our manager, and he runs sound and does all the important stuff. We just kind of goof around.
That's a fact.
And I assume this is somewhat informal in terms of banter with the audience or that kind of thing?
Yeah. Maybe more so than it should be.
You never know what's going to happen and who's going to show up and what they're going to say and yeah. What we're going to say to them.
Well, over the course of 9 years, Aaron, have there been some really memorable moments for you?
Oh, golly wally. I got to tell you, there's been so many memorable moments. Dan's laughing at the fact that I just said golly wally.
Sorry.
But one of my favorite stories is we were in a VA hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, and there was a veteran there who was sitting in a wheelchair. And after the show, I went over to him, and he stood up to give me a hug. And all the nurses just rushed over, and they didn't know what to do. And we asked, is everything okay? And they said, yeah, he has not stood up by himself in over 3 years.
Wow.
And the fact that the music had just had that power to bring him back was just amazing. It was just out of this world. It was so cool.
Dan, I note that you're a native of the Twin Cities.
Yep.
And you currently live in New York City. But you are going from city to city now.
Mm-hmm.
Any particular place stand out for you?
Well, I've had a great start to this tour. I've gotten to spend time in Denver and Seattle and Portland, which are three of my favorite cities, three of my potential I will retire here cities. So to start right there, the Pacific Northwest has been very nice to me.
And how do you take care of your voice during something as intensive as this?
Well, really, we have a lot of downtime. We spend a lot of time in the car, a lot of time in the hotel, you know. Now, Aaron and I don't often not
talk
constantly. There's not often a lull in the constant chatter.
We have noticed.
Yeah. I wondered if you picked up on that. But, you know, we drink a glass or two of water a day, try to get 3 hours of sleep a night, things like that, you know.
Well, the show is Letters from Home, Voices of Victory. It's tomorrow evening at 6:30 at Touchmark in Bismarck and at 6:30 at Touchmark in Fargo on Friday. And Aaron Diaz, Dan Beckman, the best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, Dakota Date Book.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 22nd. The railroad arrived in what is now Slope County in the fall of 1907. A tent city sprang up on the bank of the Little Missouri River. Permanent structures quickly followed. The town of Marmoth was named for Margaret Martha Fitch. She was the granddaughter of Albert J. Erling, president of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad. The town grew quickly, and by 1911, it was the fifth largest North Dakota town west of the Missouri River. The first high school graduating class in 1912 consisted of two students. By 1917, Marmoth was the only North Dakota town to have natural gas piped in for both commercial and domestic use. The water and sewer systems were completed in 1918. By then, many businesses called Marmoth home, including two banks, two hotels, a hardware store, jewelry store, laundry, post office, newspaper, gas station, and a theater. The town also boasted a hospital. But the town was not always on the genteel side. On this date in 1908, North Dakotans were buzzing after the Golden Valley Chronicle called Marmoth the wildest town in North Dakota, where blind pigs and sporting houses flourished unmolested. Virtually everyone, said the newspaper, carried a loaded revolver. In a front-page article, the Chronicle had reported on the fourth shooting of the year in Marmoth. It seems that two employees of the local bawdy house had been drinking on the evening of August 17th. They got into an argument and began to tussle over a loaded revolver. In the course of the scuffle, the revolver went off. 22-year-old Margaret Weicker lay dead. Bessie Hansen, also known as Blanche, was holding the gun. There were three eyewitnesses. Blanche was immediately arrested. The next day, the coroner and the state's attorney arrived from Beach to investigate the matter. The coroner's jury brought in a verdict of accidental shooting. The state's attorney, however, felt he had a good case against Blanche and planned to bring her to Medora for a preliminary hearing. The hearing was held on August 25th. The witnesses testified that the shooting was accidental. The case was dismissed, and Blanche was given her freedom. Afterwards, Josie McCoy was arrested and fined $50 for operating a bawdy house. With that, the sad case of Margaret Weicker's death was closed. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
The policemen sit me down and they said, well, your life was also threatened. We feel that you should not perform on stage tonight. This is Friday night. I'm headlining the Glastonbury Festival. There's like 100,000 people. No one's going to like shoot me on the Glastonbury stage under the peace sign.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
President Trump still denies the fact that Russia interfered in the U.S. elections.
No member of his own party, his director of national intelligence, all say the Russians corrupted our election to help Trump. Only Trump says it's a witch hunt.
Where is Special Counsel Robert Mueller headed next in the investigation of Russian interference? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, Fargo and Carol Capon Rachensky's book of poetry, A Beautiful Hell, will be staged in Bismarck and Grand Forks for an upcoming Game Changer Ideas Festival. And on Thursday, she will join us, that is Carol Capon Rachensky, with Lori Baker, who adapted the book for the stage, and Theater B's Carrie Winterstein, who will direct the show. Also on Thursday, Sue Belcom returns with another food topic, and Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.